Welcome to the Approaching the Natural podcast with Sid Garza-Hillman and sponsored by the Stanford Inn Eco Resort on the Mendocino coast of California. Sid is a certified nutritionist, health coach, and author of Approaching the Natural, a health manifesto, out now on Roundtree Press. Sid is also the programs director at the Stanford Inn's Mendocino Center for Living Well, one of the most holistic and integrated wellness centers in the country. The Approaching the Natural podcast explores all aspects of human health, including nutrition, movement, mindfulness, art, and much more.
Hello and welcome. This is Sid Garza-Hillman once again for the Approaching the Natural podcast. Thanks for joining me. And each week, if you haven't joined me before, each week I come on and talk about my philosophy of health, which is basically that the closer we get by degrees, and by degrees is very, very crucial, the closer we get by degrees to what is most natural for us as a species, mentally and physically, the better we do as a species and as individuals, the more we thrive. And each week I take on different things. There's recurring themes. As always, feel free to jump back and listen to the various episodes that I have posted. This is the 21st, so there's a bunch. Sometimes it's just me talking, and sometimes it's a conversation that I have with somebody who is relevant to the direction that I'm taking this podcast, and that goes for today. I talked to today a woman named Joan Stanford. She is a registered art therapist, and in case you don't know what art therapy is, which is something I didn't know about until I met her, you're in for a treat. And really what I wanted with this, I've talked about creativity. I believe it's part of who we are as a species, and like everything else, the closer we get to that and opening that up as part of us, the better we do. I think we're designed to be creative. I think we're designed to eat food that our bodies understand. I think we're designed to move our bodies. So I advocate for small steps, and that's why I am the small step advocate. Kind of fits perfectly, doesn't it? So before we get to the interview, I just wanted a couple, you know, quick announcements. This podcast is sponsored by the Stanford Inn Eco Resort on the Mendocino Coast. The Stanford Inn is it's an incredible inn. I can't tell you. There's a farm, organic farm here. There's a pool, a full wellness center that I head up. It's right on the coast. It's gorgeous. Go check it out and come visit stanfordinn.com. The wellness center here is livingwellmendocino.com. I'm running 3 transitioning to health unretreats this year in April, July, and October, I think. And there's also 3 yoga retreats that I'll be guest speaking at during the year as well. Livingwellmendocino.com. You can check those out. If you want to follow me on Instagram and Twitter, go to @SidGarzaHillman. My Facebook page is Transitioning to Health. And my private practice is transitioningtohealth.net. I am a certified nutritionist and health coach. My model fits in with this podcast and my book, Approaching the Natural Health Manifesto. My approach is to shepherd you through the process yourself. I don't hand you a diet plan. I don't hand you an exercise plan. We work literally every day for a period of time to infuse thinking and really getting underneath the surface of health and your decisions in life regarding health and what it is you truly want. But this podcast alone is a good weekly reminder. If you can jump in here and just listen to this every week, it'll get you thinking, I hope. That's my goal anyway. So that's how that goes. So one last quick announcement is that I mentioned doing a Spreecast. This is a new thing I learned about, and it's Spreecast. I'm doing it on March 1st. I think it's at noon. Anyway, if you go to Spreecast.com and search Sid Garza-Hillman, you'll see, and you can RSVP, sign up on that. And basically, it's a live event where I'll be sitting there with headphones on. So that's going to look awesome. And I'm going to answer questions live. So you can type your questions and as you're watching, and I'll pop them up on screen if they're not spam, and answer them. I think it'll be fun. So I'll do it for about an hour and a half, depending on how that goes. So that's Spreecast.com. That's March 1st. It's a Saturday. And I'm going to start doing that once a month because I do get questions. And I think some of these questions are really, a lot of them are really good questions, are really pertinent questions. And I think it's a good thing for all of us to hear the answers instead of just one person that I'm responding to via email or Twitter or anything else. So if you guys are into that, go check that out. Joan Stanford is a registered art therapist. She's board certified. And I just wanted to talk to her about it. Basically, what you know, she'll I don't want to go too far into it because she explains it, but she through creative play shops and things like that, that is her way of working with people, all sorts of people, including children. It's fascinating. But what it really meant to me was really drove home the point of how much creativity plays a part in our lives. I think you all know if you've listened to this that I'm a musician and have been for almost my whole life. And that's played a huge role. But I think for some people in the modern world, we kind of think of like, well, I don't have time for that little meaningless hobby. Like I got to take my kids to school and I got to do all things. And I totally get that. But like eating well and moving our bodies and socializing, all the things I think play into the health and happiness of our species. Creativity is one of them. And it's often left on the side. It's a back burner kind of issue. And I think it is just as crucial as anything else that we do for our health and happiness. Again, because I'm the small step advocate, when it comes to, well, maybe I would like to paint again or draw again or write or something that I used to think about doing or did as a kid and I haven't done in 30 years or 20 years or whatever, I'm going to advocate for starting really small. Because if you think you've got to take it on and huge, then you won't do it like everything else. Well, who would? Who has the time to do something like that right away? But I get into this deep with Joan and I want you to hear it. And it's a really good conversation. And I was really happy to sit down with her because I was like, okay, this is what I wanted to get to. And trust me, this isn't going to be the last time that I address this. I did quote Joan in my book too. So I kind of, and this is, I wrote the book and got the book was published long before I even thought about doing a podcast. So I think it was in the cards. So without much further ado, please enjoy, I hope, this conversation with Joan Stanford, registered art therapist. But why don't we start by just saying, just what you do, what is your background, how you even fell into this process, how did you even discover what art therapy is?
Okay, you want me to start there?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, how I developed an interest in all of this and creativity and art process really was through my children. And I guess I was like a lot of people. I was brought up and I had a the playful time of a child living in my imagination a lot, playing with my toys and my dolls and whatnot. And then as I went into school, I lost that confidence in just playing and having a curiosity about things because I started to compare what I was drawing, I'm speaking about drawing right now, yeah. With other people. And I think a lot of us do that. And so I kind of, that whole avenue of expression through media, through artistic forms, sort of shut down in me until I played with my children. And then it became fun again. Like, and we were living in the inn and we had to keep them quiet in the morning. And so we did drawing and we did things that were quiet. And I started realizing this was a lot of fun. And then a few years later...
Well, hold on. Let me stop you there for 1 second. Do you remember the time? I mean, do you think it was a natural progression in your childhood where you started to compare, or was there a period where you thought, where you took a class and then, I mean, do you remember that process where you went, this isn't fun anymore? I mean, do you remember that transition?
I kind of do remember it because I remember being, I had a lot of time to myself in the summers and I really did play very much as a young child I had an attic at my grandparents' house that I had all set up for myself and I would go there and play a lot. And then in my own home, I had like a doll hospital and I had little charts on the end of their beds and I wore a little nurse's hat and little nurse's outfit and really it was very alive to do all of that. I think children do that. They pretend and they inhabit. They're the voices of their toys, their teddy bears or whatever, and I would make up these whole scenarios where I was the creator of the whole thing. When I started school, I'm sure in elementary school back when I went through school, which was the 50s, a long time ago, we probably had mostly mimeograph type sheets. We weren't encouraged to generate or create from scratch. We would color in things that the teacher passed out. But at some point, I'm thinking it was probably around grade 3 or 4, you would notice that somebody really could draw a horse realistically, or their bodies when they drew a family or a mother or something looked much more like a real person than right. What I was drawing. So you started to get a little shyer about what you drew. And I think around that age, you're comparing yourself in a lot of different ways. Definitely by middle school, you're really comparing yourself and getting insecure. So I would say it was later elementary school, that drawing. And then when I went through the school system, there was art still as a class, as an option. And that really put the kibosh on it, because it was about learning technique, learning perspective, and it really was about skill. And certainly some people are more skillful than others. My approach to creativity is really very different now, because I believe, and I know you write about returning to the natural and what's natural, what's inherent in all of us. And I believe creativity is really life itself. Life itself expresses through each of us in a unique way. And creativity flows through each of us. I mean, we're always recreating ourselves, our hair, our nails, everything. It's constant motion. It's constant recreation. And so I actually was just listening to another podcast, and she referred to creativity as a river. And just as a river flows sometimes really fast, sometimes like a flood, sometimes it's barely a trickle, it's always varying in volume and pace and all of that. And I think creativity does flow through us, but how it flows through us varies from time to time. And sometimes we're really in touch with it. And for me, for a lot of people, they don't feel in touch with it at all.
Right.
And that's actually why I started offering the play shops here, because I feel like a lot of adults have as like I had done, have abandoned that avenue of expression for themselves. And yeah, they're kind of very scared of it.
Well, I think we feel that it's like not like, you know, you touched on the childhood aspect of creativity. I think as we become adults, we think, well, we don't have time for that. It's almost like
it's childish.
It's a waste childish. Of time. So yeah. I got a job and I got a family and why, and I got to exercise because I have to be fit, and I have to eat well because I have to be fit, but I don't have to be creative to be healthy. Right. I mean, I think most of us don't think that.
Right.
Well, see, I argue that, but.
Yes. And the reason I think we need to connect to our creativity is because when we express in any way, I think that's allowing us to be more in touch with everything that's going on inside of us, our body, our emotions, our senses. And I think to be really alive and healthy as an organism, we really need to be in touch with our own senses, our own inner sensations, and the world around us. And the more in touch you are, the more alive you are, the more you have to offer whoever you interact with, and life becomes richer for you. And really, when you do creative process, you're in the process, you're using your senses, you're engaging with materials, you're being called by the materials. They attract you just like our environments do.
Okay, so let's hold on. I'm going to stop you there just for 1 second, because I want to back up still a little bit, because that's getting into kind of how you do your practice, and I want to get deep into that. But to back into where you as an adult, where you had kids. I mean, I'm fascinated with, just because I never heard about art therapy until I met you, ever. Right. So it just wasn't a thing. Like, I would never think I should go see an art therapist. Now I'm totally fascinated by the profession. But so to back up a little bit, when you had kids and started to reintroduce creativity through them, how did that affect your direction into that practice?
Well, what happened actually, what took me to it was I had a personal crisis in my life, and in the 90s, I guess it was. And I suddenly felt really estranged from what I was doing. Everything on the outside looked absolutely perfect. I was living in beautiful Mendocino, in keeping with my husband, had two great kids, but something had shattered my sense of how life should be, let's say. And I was really on the inside falling apart. And I, at that time, my kids were taking music lessons from an expressive arts therapist here in the community. And I would take them there, drop them off, rush away to do all my errands while I had an hour to myself, and then rush back to pick them up. And somehow, and she lived on a little road, like many roads up here, where you have to turn off a paved road. You go on sort of a curvy, unpaved road. And I used to always feel like as soon as I left that main road and turned into that twisty, natural path, very natural path, and I was in the redwoods, and I was very small, and these trees were very large. Something was shifting in me just in that process, and then I realized, I guess the next step was I stopped rushing to pick up, to do my errands. I stayed in the car while my kids were with her, and one time, I just got up the nerve and I said, you know, do you ever do this kind of work with adults? And at that time it was piano lessons. I didn't know she did all this other stuff. And she said, yes, I have lots of adult students. And I had never had any music lessons. My parents didn't push that on me and I didn't seek it. We didn't have a piano. So it just wasn't part of my upbringing. And so it was very exciting to think, oh, I could become an adult beginner and play the piano. And but one of the very first sessions I had with her, we would start at a table, and she had art supplies set out. And she would usually just ask me how I was doing, you know, how I was feeling. And she would ask me to put something down on the paper.
Just, but this is, wait, so how did it go from piano lessons to...
Well, this was what she did with my kids, too. Oh. I just didn't know it because she did the same thing. She was doing expressive arts, which is all the forms of arts, all forms of arts, movement, dance, anything nonverbal. So she was doing that practice with my kids with art material.
And you just thought you were dropping off at piano lessons, basically, essentially.
Yeah. And they all had an art journal.
Was, is that how it was promoted in town?
Well, with how she did it, I knew her studio was called For the Joy of It. And so I knew she did, and I didn't want my kids to take piano lessons from someone that was like,
here's,
you know, with the ruler
on
their back or snapping or tapping their fingers. I wanted someone that approached it as a joyful, happy activity, and I knew that about her.
Okay.
And I also knew she was very, it wasn't about being the best piano player or achieving perfection.
Got it.
It was about the process of engaging with the piano and hearing the music and writing your own music. She had the kids write their own little songs.
And so you didn't want, what I'm fascinated with is, why didn't you want somebody to teach your kids piano classically with scales? What about you?
That's a good question. Yeah. I really don't know, except I was, you know, I wanted my kids to have freedom to express themselves. I don't know where that really came from.
Were your parents... In a way, did you feel that that was stifled in you and you wanted to make that different for your kids?
Not really. I don't think they stifled it. It just wasn't part of, I mean, I was left pretty much to my own resources growing up too. I grew up in the Midwest, so there's not a lot of like, how are you feeling and touchy-feely stuff. Maybe that's changing now, but not when I was growing up. So I think the feeling part of myself probably did go somewhat underground. And with my kids... And then then my career prior to being here in Mendocino, I mean, I was in social work, I was in psychology, so I was really aware that you want to not fragment your, you know, your personality, that this is the good parts I'll share and the bad parts I'll very, very deeply. I already knew that I didn't want to do that in bringing up my children.
Got it.
So we were pretty permissive with our kids, I would say. And we were very busy, so they were almost like ignored in some respects.
Right.
And they grew up in the business with us. But I don't know where I really... that's a good question. Why did I want them to have more of a free... Well, of course, Summerhill. We knew about Summerhill, and we knew about different sort of radical approaches to education.
I just remember as a kid, like, I took piano lessons as a kid, and I remember I had... I don't even remember in Los Angeles who I had as a teacher, but I remember I had an older guy, really great British guy named Mr. Hodges, who just happened to be great. I don't think my parents necessarily, I think they thought, let's give Sid piano lessons, and we found a piano teacher that they probably got a referral, but I don't think there was a, you know, a background of like, let's make it so that, you know, it's all the other things, like you were kind of coming out like, you know, really expressive and all this kind of stuff. He was pretty standard piano teacher, which interesting to me is he used to have me do these warm-up exercises.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just on the keys, and we just do warm-up exercises, and then like 5 years later, 7 years later, I realized what he had been teaching me were the scales. And I never even knew. And it was so smart, right?
Yes,
really
yes.
smart. And the other thing is he would always let me pick whatever song I wanted to learn, which I loved because I had friends who took piano lessons and they just dreaded it because I had to learn, you know, Beethoven's, you know, Furlis. And they were just like, ah. And then he was just like, what sucks? I would get contemporary music that I liked.
Right.
And then learn that. And that was such a way for me to go, I love this. You know,
yes.
So he was really smart that way. But I don't think it was an intent necessarily on my parents' part. I should ask them because I don't really know.
But it's a backdoor in. And I think with children, especially if you, well, with adults too, if you say you have to do this, like with diets, you know, you should do it this way, and there's a right way and a wrong way. There's an inner rebel in all of us that just kind of rebels against that. Like, you're telling me to do it this way. Okay, I'll do it this
way. Well, I've touched upon that. Like, we're all kids. I've said that before in the hot podcast, like, we're all kids.
Mm-hmm.
And it is like, if I, as a nutritionist, if I take things away from people, they just get pissed. Like, mm-hmm. Who wants that? But who wants that anyway?
Right.
They want to make that decision on their own, and that's fine.
Yeah.
You know?
And I'm not saying anything against that other approach to learning music. And I think it can also open up someone to their love of music just as much.
Right.
But for some reason, and maybe it's just the culture of Mendocino, they didn't want them to feel that strict discipline. Even as I was taking lessons from her, you know, I had homework to practice things, but it didn't feel the same way because, I don't know, and maybe I'm imagining how it would be in this other system, but anyway.
Well, it was definitely a larger picture of art and creativity, which I really find fascinating. I mean, yes. It's such a cool way to teach piano. I never would think that, like to teach piano to a kid. You sit in front of a piano and you teach them the notes and you go from there, you know, whatever. But it's interesting that even, so did you actually learn piano though?
Oh, yes, I did.
So it was in the context of piano lessons.
Yes, and I mean, so much of it, actually, this is really funny. I hadn't even thought about this for a while, but one of the things at the time, and she was the one, just to finish that, how I got into this, was she had taken courses through Sonoma State and gotten a degree. And so that's how I first learned about the whole field. And I actually went through and got my master's in art therapy or psychology with an art therapy.
What's your bachelor's degree in?
It's in sociology and English, double major minor in philosophy.
Right. And so what was your intention after your bachelor's degree?
Well, I was going to be a social worker. And then, yes. And then,
we never talked about this.
I know. And then well, I loved philosophy. I love those circles.
Why did we never talk about this?
I don't know.
That's my bachelor's degree.
I know.
You never mentioned to me that you had a minor in philosophy.
Well, that was your area, Sid.
And you don't, that's really funny.
But it's a great way to, I think it attunes your thinking.
Yeah.
I love the book, the logic. Anyway, yeah. I still have my book of logic with all those little circles. I still do that when I have a problem. I'll often intersect circles and see, oh, here's where it really is.
Logic was my, the one class I had to take where, this just came up recently, but it was the one class I had to take to satisfy. I was pretty good in math in high school, but then I got burnt and I hated math. So I went through 4 years at UCLA without taking any single math class because I had satisfied my prerequisite in high school. But I had to take some sort of math, whatever it was in the general ed thing, but I was able to take philosophy logic to satisfy that. So it was the logic, like if then statements and the whole thing. And this just came up because my daughter had a math problem that I could not solve. And anyway, so I remember taking a test. This is just an aside, stupid story, but I remember taking a test and could not figure out, it was a makeup test, and I could not figure out this one problem. And I worked for literally 30 minutes and I was so frustrated. And finally just couldn't do it. And I took it to the TA's office and said, I can't do this. And I'm really frustrated. And I really studied hard for this. Can you just show me how to do it? And it's fine. I'm turning it in. He goes, yeah. And he's all kind of smug and he stands up and puts it on the whiteboard and he's showing me, here's what you do. And he kind of, and he does it. And then he's like, well, let me, hold on. No, you do it. And then he kind of, anyway, turns out he had copied it wrong.
Yes, I was going to say, I love that when you.
So sure enough, my 9-year-old daughter has a math problem. 2 weeks ago, and I couldn't figure it out. And I spent 30 minutes at night, and so I took it to her teacher, and I was like, I'm not like the best at math, but tell me how to do this. And it was also he was like, here's how you do it. I was like, that's not how you do it. And he's like, well, no, you. Oh yeah, that is kind of weird. And it was
yes, like teaching the teacher
twice in my life. He couldn't figure it out either. Twice in my life, I was like validated by for math. But anyhow, that was my philosophy story. But what was your intent originally in the so sociology, English, and philosophy?
Then
very
I went
well.
Into social work.
Oh, it's directly into social work.
Yeah.
And then did you have to give a certification?
I went into a master's social work program, and the program I was in, I completed my first year. The second year was going to be a thesis. And at that point, I decided I really didn't want to do it. I think social workers are incredibly, I have so much respect for them. But for me personally, I felt ill-suited, like to go in. I was young. I did come from a stable middle-class home, and I was going into the inner city slums with this clipboard assessing whether they were entitled to a new stove or whatever. Right. I mean, it was with a family center that I was working, and I just always felt so uncomfortable, like making judgments.
Uh-huh.
And the thing about art therapy, what I loved about art therapy, at least the way I was taught in my particular program, is that authority is not part of the process. It isn't like someone's coming to me like because I have any answers. What they're coming for is to explore and then express what they're finding in that exploration. And it's for both of us. We're exploring together. We're co-exploring. I don't like give them something and know the answer ahead of time. And what's important for them to deal with will emerge through the process if they have a problem that they're coming to solve.
Right.
Obviously they bring that, but as you know very well from doing nutrition counseling, there are so many layers beneath the stated obstacle to why things aren't working in their lives, to their impediments to health and happiness. And so those self-defeating beliefs and patterns are sometimes so under the surface of our knowing that having a nonverbal process to get there allows these things to emerge, and then we see them and they're heard and seen, and then we can relate to them and maybe untangle some of, like, where did that come from? Whose voice is that? And who's telling you, you know, you're unlovable and you should always be unhappy and, and unhealthy.
But it was this woman who inspired you to go, well, what's going on over there? Let me go see about that.
That process with her and using the art tied at the same time that I was dealing with this
crisis,
it allowed this incredible opening and healing for me. And it was like, I think you believe this in your work too. Our body has this knowing. Our body has a wisdom. I mean, I think I remember when my children were very little, they said, you don't really have to feed your kid. Just put some stuff there and they'll eat what they need.
That's
So if a child comes in knowing what they need, I think, you know, our bodies have an incredible amount of wisdom that we don't always tap into.
Did you go to that piano lesson, you know, loosely piano lesson, with an intent to deal with the crisis?
No.
So you just went because you thought this would be fun.
Yes.
I want to learn. I want to take piano.
Yes.
So that what I want to get to is, and I want to get into this as, so then you go get your master's and you become an art therapist.
And
you become board
certified.
And
this is all over. It didn't happen day by day, but
you're still working and you own it and everything. So, but you started taking clients. Essentially.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So the difference that I see is that, or not difference, but what's fascinating to me is that through the process of the piano lessons that you took, and in doing that, you had an opening with regards to your own life and your own crisis. You found that healing, but you didn't go there for healing.
I didn't.
Okay.
I didn't. Maybe I did and I didn't know it.
Right. But not, you didn't go like, I mean,
the slowing down was the first thing, really, when I actually am writing a book, and the first step is slowing down enough so that you're not just on a treadmill of your life. You're actually able to reflect on your life a little bit. And I think that slowing down was incredibly important for me because I was super busy. I mean, you're super busy too. But you have to have somewhere in your life these pockets where you feel like you have the ability to say, wait, just a moment.
Uh-huh.
And it's like taking a breath.
Yeah.
People will often do that as a practice. Just to go back inside for a moment. And my, as I say, I was so disconnected from my inside until something made me realize, well, here's a disconnect. Here's what people are seeing and I'm putting this out, but that's really not true for me anymore. I'm going through this other stuff on the inside.
Yeah.
But I also felt it was very self-indulgent. I had that message in my head.
Interesting.
And
you shouldn't take
this.
See, I talk about selfishness a lot because I think the message is, of course, especially for mothers, I think that they have that.
Right.
There's a certain caring predisposition or at least like a role that they think they need to play, especially when it comes to kids, that they have to give up what they need to make sure that the family is, you know. And that's, you know, of course, I argue that the more you take care of yourself, the better you can take care of others.
And it's so true.
Yeah, but there is that underlying thing, and I get that a lot still, like, well, I don't, this is not my time, you know, like, my husband, he needs, like, oh, you deal with yourself, you know. That's
and
why
it's
you're
a
here.
Way we deal with ourselves often. Like, you know, it's that classic thing, like, if you think that person really needs to slow down and really needs to look at their life, they're really messed up. You better think, well, wait a minute, is that for me or is that for them?
Uh-huh.
And that's often true. But the, so the slowing down, I would say, was the first thing. And that allowed me, because I would write, you know, I would have a little notepad or something, and I would just start writing things. And the work I did with her, with the drawing and the write, and it was drawing just to express something. It wasn't like pictorial drawing.
Yes.
And so it would kind of be like, you know, how are you feeling? And if I came in feeling really rushed, well, what does that look like? You know, and is it a
just
swirl?
Abstract.
Yeah, abstract. Yeah, just put something down. And a lot of the times it was like I would be frozen. I wouldn't, like, what do you mean put something down?
Uh-huh.
And this is really, I think the benefit of my doing this work is that I was not trained as an artist, and I had such a, a sense that talented people were artists, that the fact that I came to it and it was such a powerful tool for transformation for myself, it's easier for me to offer that to other people. When you're a trained artist, it's kind of really hard to abandon that training and just get into this expressive place where you don't really care what it looks like, because you do care what it looks like.
As an aside, when you went to get your, I just poured myself coffee, that's why you're hearing the, you know, I have to talk about coffee. I have to talk about coffee at least once during every interview. When you were in school to get your master's, how many people on average do you think were trained artists? Low or high?
High.
High. High. Interesting.
Yeah, okay, a lot of people that they wanted to, you know, it's very hard to make a living as an artist, so they would turn to some field where they could still be using their creativity, their artwork.
Yeah.
And a lot of people that are art therapists are wonderful artists. I mean, the covers of the journals are like usually, so that there's that still comes up for me that I'm not a real artist, but I own that I use the art for my own purposes, and it's about the process. But it does become about the product. I mean, like, I still, you know, you bring your own aesthetics to it.
Sure.
But, yeah, I think that's an easier thing for me to shift into that than if I was really seriously trained. And I use collage for myself a lot, and anyone can access collage. It's very, you know, very easy to get.
Well, let's get into a little bit about what you actually do, because, of course, people...
And how it's healthy, let's not forget.
Well, because the thing about, of course, I can distill that down into saying that, you know, releasing, just like in journaling and things like that, going through that process is very on a very physical level, a stress release.
Yeah.
Right. But then, of course, there's also way deeper issues at hand, I'm sure, that come up. I find it interesting just as a nutritionist, because I talk about the fact that oftentimes in my nutrition practice, when you start working with somebody on the food is such a thing that we do all day, every day. So then when you make adjustments about that, when somebody comes to me and says they want to eat better and they start eating better, all of a sudden the distractions that they used to go to for food are decreased. And when there's less distractions, the things that they were distracting themselves from come up.
Absolutely.
And then it's like, I got to go, okay, this is outside my training because I'm not a psychologist. So now that these things are coming up, I can still help you with the small steps, but maybe it's good for you to go through this process. I think it's really interesting with a psychologist or an art therapist or whatever. I do think it's interesting that on more than one occasion, a lot actually, if you talk to most people, there is a certain thing that they used to do artistically that they miss. It's like almost 100%. You know, like I have a client in Seattle and I was just like, have you ever, you know, one of the things I do with my students is I go, clients is I go, what would your life be like if you didn't have to eat or drink anything? I create this scenario where I go, if every night you plugged in your bed and you got exactly perfect nutritional and caloric needs for what you needed and hydration, such that when you woke up, you literally you wouldn't drink or eat anything all day. What would you do with your time? And a lot of times people are just like, oh, that would be miserable because they love food. But then when they think about it and I have them write about it, there's a whole bunch of stuff that they would go, well, actually, I'd write a book that I always wanted to write. And you know, so sure enough, this one client was like, I said, do you ever think about art? She's like, well, I have a canvas over there in my paint. I just haven't touched it in 6 months. Right. Because I do think it's part of us. And that's why art.
It's in all of us.
Right. I mean, there's not most people, I don't care what walk of life, probably did music or writing or painting or something. And then boom, it's gone.
Mm-hmm.
And so now you're an art therapist and people are coming to you. And I'll come back to it one more time. I really think it's fascinating that you were able to deal with a crisis you had without the intent of going to an art therapist for crisis. So if you could speak on that a little bit, that what is the process of creativity such that these things do come up, even involuntarily?
Well, I'll give you the example that I actually write about in my book as well. But one of the very first times we were together, and I still had, as I said, young children, she asked me what was my greatest fear. And I said to her to have a child go missing. And I don't remember if it was the polyclass thing or some news thing.
Which one of your kids? I'm joking.
Yes, you are. I expect that. I welcome that. Anyway, I talked a little bit about that, like just like in conversation, like, you know, because the idea that somewhere your child was out there and your imagination would go down all these horrible alleys of what was happening to them.
Which they do anyway, even without them missing, you know, like a fear, you know, like.
Well, it's a big
daily
thing.
Yeah.
So anyway, and so then she said, you know, and we would, you know, draw something, or sometimes we didn't, and then we would do our piano thing, and she'd often ask me to do something as homework. And at this time she said, well, when you go home, I'd like you to sometime just sit down and do a poster like they have in the post office for the missing child,
right,
for the missing child part of you. And I went home, and I'm a good little student, so I got out, and I only had the newsprint, a pad of newsprint, fairly large pad of newsprint, but that my kids had, and I had, you know, the little 8 or 6, whatever it is, watercolor set that they had, and I went up, I don't remember where I did it, actually, because it was always so chaotic, but in any case, I sat down, and I made these watery letters just with the watercolors across the top, M-I-S-S-I-N-G, and then I just kind of kept going and, you know, put something. And the thing of it is, the way she had sort of shepherded me through this is that one thing leads to the other. Don't have any plan. Like, don't think, oh, I'm going to put a bow in the hair. I'm going to put a necklace around the neck. You just kind of start somewhere and let that lead you to the next thing. Okay, make a kind of oval shape. That's going to be my head. That's going to be the face of this missing child part of me. So I made this oval thing. And then the next thing I thought about, well, what does a child have? And I thought, they have really wide open eyes. And so I made these eyes and I put these sort of radiating things out from the pupil point. And they were like rainbow eyes. And then I thought, you know, oh, you know, they're going to have apple cheeks. Kids have rosy cheeks. So I put these apples in the cheeks. Anyway, the whole process emerged, this face emerged, and it was like this child with little barrettes in the hair, these wide rainbow eyes and cheeks. And I started to write about it. And I wrote, where is the child with wide rainbow eyes, crescent moon barrettes, and sunshine hair? You know, and then it went on, where is the child of purple and red, you know, asleep or dead, an adult instead? That was the last stanza of this little free writing that I did. And it was like this amazing process to me, because first of all, I loved it. I actually have it on my business card. But I loved this image of this little girl part of me. And somehow it was such a powerful shift that I could do this, number one. It was so unexpected. And a huge part of creativity is curiosity and having a curious approach to life and things that happen to you, rather than a kind of, you know, cynical, know-it-all kind of thing. And so when you awaken curiosity, that's already starting the whole creative process. And I was really curious, like, oh my God, I did this. And right. There was that part too, that authorship that mm-hmm. I created this, which is also the empowerment piece you do, I know, with nutrition counseling. You want people to connect that they're making these choices.
That's right.
They're putting this in their mouth.
That's right.
They're buying that off the shelf. You bring it back to who's doing it.
Yeah.
Because that's the other piece in creativity. It has to be you. I can't put a mark on the paper for you.
Right.
I mean, I might, if someone is really, really stuck, I might start them with something. I mean, I've done that with some kids just because they're really frozen. But then they go for it, you know. But to come back to that place of authority, like where it originates with you, the originator, the creator type person, it was huge. And I, you know, things sort of started from then on. Then I turned to drawing and writing. That became my process, or collaging and writing. Mm-hmm. And it really started at that point. So the piano music kind of receded a little. But
even
then,
in the lesson?
Even. There would be more talk. She would even have sometimes put on music for me and invite me to just close my eyes and imagine something that was going on in the music and move around. I mean, she brought in different modalities into our hour together. So it was quite an awakening, if you like. And what happened in all of that, and I think this is part of the healing, is the attention shifted. The attention shifted from the pain or the wounding or the distress to something else, which was what I was doing. I was more in the present moment rather than thinking about something that was bothering me. I was doing something in that present moment, which is, I think, another really big aspect of using creative process. It's all about the process, not the product. And it's about being engaged in the moment, which is, to me, what healthy living is. You're alive in the moment. You're not imagining, even though it's an imagination, I'm talking about the imagination a lot, but you're not imagining, you know, what it's going to be like in 10 years from now and postponing things or putting them off. You're thinking, I have this day to do these things that are important to me.
And the power of actually acting.
Acting.
Right.
And making choices.
Right.
Because when you're doing anything, whether it's piano playing or not, you're picking one note, then the next note. Uh-huh. You're picking a color, you're picking a brush, you're picking a stroke. You're making all these decisions. I always used to say it's like a laboratory. It's a practice for making decisions. And you're making decisions there that just automatically translate outside of that laboratory of the art studio. You're becoming more of a decision maker.
Right.
And you're a rule breaker. You can do whatever you want in there. It's totally permissive. Uh-huh.
Interesting. Okay. So that's the other thing is that when you move away from the idea of art, I love how when kids are like, you know, the teachers sometimes can have an effect on the kids artistically because they can say, that looks perfect. It looks just like a horse, when that's really not the most important thing.
Yeah.
Right? right. But I think that's early. That is the shift for a lot of us. It's like, well, I can't draw a house as good as that kid.
Right.
Because he made a house that looked exactly like a house.
Exactly.
And mine looks like a house with a crooked
whatever. And it has
whatever.
Windows and a chimney and
smoke.
Yeah,
exactly. And you're like, damn, You know, but really, it has nothing to do with that at all.
No,
it doesn't. At all. Even if you become a professional artist, it has nothing to do with that.
Right.
I mean, Picasso's figures didn't look like the figures. I mean, that was the whole point, is he has an interpretative,
exactly,
you know, bent on it.
From him, his own personal vision.
That's right. And
but so, I wanted to get back to what I was going to say.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I go off on tangents here. But the piano part, the part it receded, but what was funny about the piano part, and that's where I was headed, was one of the pieces I was learning was Can-Can. And so here I am doing this work that's starting to feel like I can make changes in my life. And I'm playing this piece of music that can, and it was kind of like, I can really do things in my life. I can make changes that I need to make. And so, and there was another one too, and I can't remember what that one was, but a piece of music that we played. And she also did the same thing you were saying your teacher did. Like, I used to love the one, it was The River is Wide, I Can't Cross Over, Nor Have I Wings with Which to Fly. And I always loved that song. So, you know, I got to play that song, and then she wanted me to write my own little music to something else. But there were a couple of times when the synchronicity would happen, that something was happening for me internally, and then it would be reflected in either the piece of piano I was working on. And we did a lot of duets, which was also really fun, because fun is a huge part of it. You
right.
can't be, at least the way I approach it, you can't be doing this work and not have that playful, fun aspect come into it. That element has to be there.
Right.
So for anything to change.
We'll get into art there, you know, the practice. Well, let's get into that. I have a question about that. So when you have a client come in, what, and you said like you're not, it's coming from them. In a sense, you mentioned somebody shepherding. I think you mentioned somebody shepherding, but you essentially are shepherding somebody through that process.
Yeah.
Okay. As an art therapist, as a trained art therapist, is there times in your practice where you are interpreting somebody's work or a comment that they make? I mean, where's the therapist part step in?
The therapist part, the way I approach it and the way I was trained, is I'm asking invitational questions. And so if something is in there, there's no interpretation or judgment coming from me about them. If they drew I've worked mostly with kids and in the schools. So if a kid drew a really, really scary monster type thing, I might ask them to talk to me about that.
Uh-huh.
But I wouldn't be like thinking, oh, that's a really scary monster right off the bat, because maybe that monster isn't scary to him.
Got it. Okay.
Or they could be using a lot of black. I love the story of this is a cartoon, I think, but where some kid was using a ton of black and everyone was very concerned, and all the case notes were, this is a severely depressed kid. It turned out the kid was always the last one to sit down, and all the other colors
crayon.
Were gone.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so he had to paint with black.
And they thought he was crazy.
And it's like, you know, so the judgments we make, I always have to find out, is that monster scary to him? And it might not be. It might be like his superhero that protects him. And
got
I would
it.
Be very wrong if I said, oh boy, that's a scary
then
monster.
Then that sends a message of he should be scared of that hero
yeah.
for him. Yeah,
so you want to find out what it is for them. The way you can guide them is, let's say they're, and it depends on the process of the work with the person. You don't want to bring something to the surface that they're not ready to deal with, but it will come out on the page maybe. A lot of times when I did my training in family therapy, it comes out a lot, like the way they'll ask the kid to represent the family. And what they're looking for when, as a therapist, what you're looking for when you analyze it, not with the kid,
yes,
but
got it.
Later, like how close are the members together?
Uh-huh,
is the father out in the garage
got
doing
it.
Something and all the rest of the family is really tight?
So that is part of what you do also.
You would do that for your own understanding of the person and what the person might be dealing.
Uh-huh.
And if there's a problem, like if the problem is like an emotionally unavailable spouse, say,
yeah.
and all the pictures that this woman is drawing, like shows the husband, you know, with his back turned, or there's certain things
yes,
you'll see
little
on the
markers.
Page.
Yeah.
They might not have mentioned that. They might say, oh, I have a really good marriage. I have a really supportive
uh-huh.
husband. But every time they
the art tells otherwise.
And you may not give that direct, you may not ask them directly to do that. It might be in the course of something, like with a child, for example, you want to learn some information about the child, but you'll often do it through animals because then they'll inhabit the animal and give
got
you
it.
Information about that. I don't know if that's what you're trying to get to.
Well, no,
but,
I am.
But
I wonder where the line is between, you know, you creating a space where somebody can create and maybe, so in other words, you had some things occur through your own art process with that expressive arts teacher that wasn't necessarily with her acting as a therapist, but it was more the process that spoke to you.
Yeah.
There were things that opened up to you she was just there.
And she's the training is really about being very, very present and listening very attentively to what is being said and what is not being uh-huh. said, to be really present to what is appearing, what is emerging, and, you know, with all of your senses uh-huh. as well as what's there. And you're trying to, if someone, I mean, the thing of it is that I think the most powerful thing about it, and I'll give an example from the middle school when I worked there, is it's a container. It's a container for powerful emotions, and it allows things to come out in a safe way that, especially for children, would be maybe very scary for themselves or cause a repercussion with the school or with their parents or uh-huh. whoever has power over them. So I had one kid who had terrible nightmares, and he had reason to have nightmares. He had quite some difficult things in his life. But what we did with, and this took a little while because I would do collage and I would do some play things and different things before we got to the point where he was really talking about these scary things. And so at one point I had him, he drew it, and it was really scary to him. And I said, well, what do you need to, you know, to take care of yourself with this scary thing here? And so he started to fold it up. Like he folded it in half, then he folded it.
Closing it off.
And he made it very small. Like he made it really small. And then we made a box, and I said, does it still feel safe? Well, it still didn't feel safe. So I had different materials, and I had boxes because kids love often to do a box, decorate the outside and inside of a box. And the outside is their world out there, and the inside is all their private thinking uh-huh. and feelings and stuff. So anyway, I had boxes, and he took a box, he decorated the box, he put this inside the box. Then he wrapped the box
Whoa.
Like with paper again,
yeah.
and then he tied it with ribbon.
Yeah.
And then he asked me to keep it in my drawer in my Whoa. Office. So that process was, I mean, I'm just giving it as an example, like it was a very powerful process for him to externalize something that uh-huh. was, and he did find, I mean, it wasn't instant, but it did start to help him sleep better.
Yeah.
That thing, and I, you know, and we did talking, and I did a process about creating safety for him and had him draw what he needed to feel safe for himself.
Right.
But for this scary thing to be outside of his head, outside yeah. of his psyche, in this tightly wrapped, very hidden in this tiny little piece of paper, eventually in this box in my office, meant that he didn't have to deal with it quite in the same way.
Yes.
And that's the kind of thing that happens. There's right. The page itself is a container. There's borders there. Some people that have a lot of problems with boundaries, that immediately imposes a boundary. And then you can invite them to go outside of that.
Interesting.
And that's a powerful thing for some people. Uh-huh. Some people draw really small, and some people draw really big. And right. it's often not who you would think.
Right.
Like the really extroverted person might have a small. Really hard time.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And vice versa.
Yeah. So you are getting underneath the surface, which is what fascinates me. And that's, I mean, I advocate for journaling, which is more, I guess, blatant. You know, it's a little less subtle than artwork, but it's still getting something inside out.
Yeah.
I also sometimes advocate for somebody if it's, you know, if when they start with the intention of writing that they're going to destroy the page afterwards, sometimes yep. that allows a place that they can just let it roll, you yeah. know? And so, you know, that's again, just the process of healing. But do you see, okay, so that kind of describes what I wanted to get to in the way that your sessions work and the way that you create that place for somebody to go through that process. I guess what I want to get to is you're shepherding people through. Is how much of a barrier to the beginning the process of creativity do you experience when people walk into your office because most adults just don't do creative work anymore? What is the tension between a creativity that I think you and I both see exists in all of us mm-hmm. inherently mm-hmm. and the fact that we've closed it off for so many years, many of us? How is it just to get that ball rolling? I mean, how much uncomfort is there? Discomfort is
well,
there?
Well, you know, if they're going to come, I offer these play shops at the Wellness Center, right. as you know. And if they're going to sign up to do it with me, that's already an opening in them. They're uh-huh. admitting to themselves, I have this little thing pulling at me. And I just did one yesterday, actually, which was synchronistic with doing this talk today. And she had said she'd been thinking about asking me for the whole time they were here, which was just a few days. But she didn't ask me until the very last day. And what made her ask me, can you do one, is I would regret it if I didn't do it. And that's kind of a neat thing to think about. So I think the fact that they even come. And then when they come, I usually just take a few minutes to chat, see if they have a specific thing they want to have happen in that time. But if not, we just do some warm-up exercises, and I remind them of how they, you know, had a very vivid imagination probably as a child. Uh-huh. And I try to get them to think of what they loved to do as a child and how that felt, so they start to feel in the body maybe that aliveness again. And I usually find out if they do have anything that they consider creative activity, like some of them are gardeners, some of them are cooks. It manifests in our lives in different ways. Right. And I certainly reinforce that's valid. And then I explain my approach to it, that it's basically just inviting them to be spontaneous. There's no right or wrong. They have total permission to do whatever they want. They can copy whatever they see if they're inspired by something. And then one of the warm-ups I have them do is basically a spontaneous writing thing prompted by objects. I have an array of objects out there.
Got it.
And they can select. And the objects I have on this table are you know, somewhat symbolic, metaphor connections. So you're already starting them to think a little deeper than just the surface, because if you select, say, a key or a heart or a piece of driftwood, your mind is already thinking of associations about that just even in selecting it, unconsciously,
yeah,
I think. And I ask them to do it without much thought.
Yeah.
And then I have them do a really quick little writing exercise on the things they pick, like I am a rock or I am a whatever, and just see what happens. And very often that just opens up the fact that they can do this because they're doing it.
Yeah.
And I usually invite them to take three things. And then at the end of writing those three separate things, I ask them to see if there's any connection that they see. Is there any story that's wanting to be told?
Got it.
And I'd say about 9 times out of 10, they come up with something. So they're already creating.
Yeah.
And I ask them if it has anything to do with their, can they see anything that relates to their life, their current life.
So
there is a warm up. And then I also have everything spread out, because for me, in my own process, whenever I go to a workshop, I am so turned on by materials.
Uh-huh.
And I'm a collector of stuff. And so if I see like a box of colored feathers and a box of ribbons and a bunch of different colored paper and different colored materials, I already want to engage with those. It just excites me.
Right.
So I also have things spread out too, and I offer them different options of what they might do. And then and I have music, and sometimes we might do a little ritual at the beginning where I ask them to get into this time and space with breathing or whatever. Might have them pick a card.
Yeah.
I have different inspirational decks and they can relate to that, but just something to shift gears and to let them know that it's easy. It's not this huge hurdle. If they're really having a hard time, and there's all sorts of stuff around too to stimulate them. If they're really having a hard time, again, I just ask some questions and to sort of prompt them.
Yeah. Got it.
And I don't think, as I say, it's already self-selective that they're there.
Yeah.
And most of them.
Do you ever get couples? I get nutrition class couples where one of them wants to and the other one so does not want to be there.
No, the couples I've had, when I've had two people, are really both. It's actually really neat to see how they all get excited by each other.
Yeah, usually it's one of the spouses is like, let's go take a nutrition class, and they're just dragging the spouse in. You know, and that's my challenge. I'm like, I'm breaking that person down.
Like, and that's hard.
I'm going to make this fun if that's the last thing I do.
That's really hard. And also that's another thing, like what we were talking about, where somebody really wants to make that change in themselves, but especially as a woman, it's easier to say, you need this.
Uh-huh.
You need to take better care of yourself. Uh-huh. And so
I get a lot of like the wife will just like elbow the husband, and the, you know, I'll say something about stress, whatever, like acid forming foods make you grouchy and irritable, and she'll just boom, elbow in the side, you know.
Oh, I need to know that. Yeah.
You know, it's like the guy's like, you know, it's all in
how
good
do
fun.
Is it okay for me to ask you a question?
Yeah.
So how do you get them into it to
I'm
be more open?
That. I'm not going to answer that. I usually use humor.
Yeah.
Honestly. And the thing is, I frame this, the first question I ask in my talks is why eat healthy, which seems like the most mundane, stupid question, but it's a beginning of a conversation of really let's get down to what we're talking about here. And I do that with my podcast too. It's like, yeah, you want to lose weight, but that's not really what you want. That's not really what you want. What you want is to be happy and healthy, and you want to feel good, and you want to present to the world in that way. You want to maybe have a better job, and you maybe want to have a better relationship, and it's all starting with you. So you and I have the same exact message.
Right.
But I try to frame, they think they're walking in to learn about, you know, carbohydrates, fat, and protein. But what they're really getting is, yes, but through that vehicle, we're going to get down to why did you walk in my door?
Right.
And why did you walk in my door? I mean, that's what we're getting at, is the quality of your life. That's what we're talking about. It's
right.
So far beyond a flat stomach. That's just a symptom of,
and that's an outside looking in thing. And you're talking about the inside.
Like, yeah.
You know,
I always say weight, your healthy weight is a side effect of your weight is a side effect of your health.
Right. And happiness is a side effect of doing something that gives you pleasure.
That's exactly right. And that's why creativity is a major as equal as anything else in my picture of health.
Right.
It really is. And that's why I'm talking to you because you know more than I do on it. And because that's why that's part of my picture of health. So it's like so far beyond diet and food. Everyone goes, diet and exercise, diet and exercise, diet. It's like, it's a big picture, man. You can be fit and thin and be totally unhappy. And that's how you're going to present in the world, no matter how you look.
And we know vegans cannot be, vegans can be difficult people, but they're eating very healthily, maybe.
Well, sometimes.
Sometimes, not.
I usually don't even talk about vegan or vegetarian in this podcast because it's not even about that.
It's
because
not about
some of
that.
The most unhealthy food in the world is vegan, French fries. You know, so this is about what is the message that you take when you nourish yourself with healthy food.
Yes.
And so what's fascinating for me with the work you do is what is the message that you are giving yourself when you take time to get back in touch with creativity, which is already there. And I want to get into that a little bit because you touched on it a little bit, but I want you to speak to the fact that while many adults aren't doing creative work per se, you know, we're not painting or we're not, you know, I play music now and then, but we can bring creativity to virtually anything.
Absolutely.
And do we already, even if we're not doing, I'm not an artist, I haven't painted in 20 years.
Yeah, I do not. Yeah. I totally am at that place where it's not about being any label. Living creatively, I always get tied up on that. When you bring creativity to everything you do, to me, it's a life thing. I mean, it's every moment of your life, really. It's just not always conscious that we're doing that. But solving problems, that's a creative activity.
You're an art therapist. Why should you be able to say creatively?
But I mean, you know, I putting clothes on, like what I decide to wear today. Will I wear this color with that color? I mean, everything we do, really, that is coming in. That's an expression of it.
Already is. But what happens when you shift to actually being conscious of that and approaching life from doing the same things you do every day? You go to the same job, you get in the same car, you eat the same food. But if you come at it from a mindset of creativity, or at least being acknowledging,
having
that
a bigger, it shifts. I mean, one of the stories I've told, I know I've told it at managers meetings here, but one of the stories I loved hearing was where somebody's walking past these two workmen. This is in the Middle Ages, let's say, and they're two masons and they're building a brick wall or something. And one guy's like barely engaged in the process. He's like, it's real drudgery. He's picking up a brick. He's throwing in his whatever that cement thing was back then, and with his trowel. And the other one is like, you know, really kind of joyfully doing the same job. He's like sprightly. He's picking it up. He's putting it there carefully. He's, you know, doing everything like with care and joy almost. And somebody says to him, you know, what are you doing? And the first guy says, I'm putting bricks in a wall. And the other guy says, I'm building a cathedral. And so that's the intention part of it too, I think. But if you intend to live your life with more of your creativity available to you, I think you're automatically engaging in a different way. You're more open as you walk to work, or if you're lucky enough to walk to work, or when you go for a walk, when you interact with your kids or your husband or your wife or whoever, you're just more in your senses. And, you know, the earth, you talk about returning to the natural. And I mean, our bodies, we're here in a body and we're on the earth, which supports us every time we walk. And yet we get disconnected from our bodies. We live in our minds or our personality, ego part. And so anything you do, what you eat, the consciousness you bring to what you eat, when you do anything with that, I mean, mindful is getting so overused right now, but when you bring attention.
Jeff and I were trying to think of a different word besides mindful.
To me, it's attention. I actually, before I came here, I was looking at attention, because to me, that's what being creative is paying attention and lovingly paying attention, witnessing things that you do or see and letting them come into you so that they inspire. To me, it's very interactive creativity. It isn't like it's just me and the paper. It's like it's much broader than that. Plus, I think it also connects each of us to the bigger picture. I mean, to go back to my story, like if I'm feeling pain or I'm feeling suffering, when you do this process and it opens you up more and more so that it becomes suffering in the abstract. Everybody suffers. Everybody has to deal with issues. It allows your heart to open in a different way. And, you know, that's compassionate to feel that you're one with something else. It allows connection to one another. I mean, one of the things when I worked at the high school with, I had a class for girls because I really felt that girls were so subjected to all the stuff in the media about what they were supposed to look like and how they were supposed to act. And right. I did want to empower them to have a different way of looking at themselves and have a broader view of beauty, let's say, right. and inner beauty. And I've lost my train of thought.
That's all right.
What was I saying about
just
that?
Being creative.
Oh, the connection. The connection. Okay. Yeah. So and so they all think they're the only one that feel this way.
Right.
But as we did these collages and we did writing exercises, we did all sorts of things.
All of a sudden it's
like, oh my gosh, the girl that they thought had everything together
with
a cute girl was just as insecure as they were.
Right.
And it came out not through having a conversation, but because she'd do the exact same kind of imagery. I mean, not the exact same, her own unique version, but it would be on a topic.
Yeah.
And then as they shared, so you start to stop seeing the outer person and you start to feel like, oh my goodness,
we're all doing this. I mean, I find that with food. It's like I did a whole episode on addiction because I think people think somebody who's really overweight, it's like, why don't they just eat less?
Yeah.
And it's like when I try to appeal that we're all, including me, in the modern world with packaged food and manipulated food, it touches on the addictive center for us, the pleasure center. And when we understand that, then somebody who's more overweight than you is just degrees.
Yeah.
But we all have the same struggles and that person deserves empathy.
Yeah.
Not even sympathy, but empathy, because once you become aware of the fact that you too are struggling every day because it's tripping up our natural drive to have an Oreo in front of us. It's not natural. And when we're confronted with that, we have to understand that we battle with that just like everybody else does, you know, and some people have a harder time with it than others, no matter how they present in the world.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's powerful now.
And to connect to others' insides is the way that you get there. I mean, someone can, and we all project onto other people and we all imagine other people's lives and what goes on there. But when you actually get to hear their story or see their story or whatever, and as you say, then it's like, you know, and when you say that even though you're thin, you're dealing with these issues and I'm dealing with these issues, it's like, it allows this lack of judgment is such a impediment to being happy. I think that's self-judgment and judgment of others is what gets in the way of our feeling good about ourselves and other people.
Yeah.
And I struggle with that. I mean, I can be really harsh on myself still and with other people. And
right.
I'm always, it pops up and I think, now, where did that come
from? Yes, that's the behind the veil, which I always talk about behind the veil. It's like, I always talk about like the judgment, it just seems to occur enough.
Yes.
And so instead of fighting that, instead just go, well, where did that come from?
Yeah.
What's up with that? Maybe that's about me.
And I don't like it. And that's the other thing. The thing with doing the way I approach it is we tend to, I remember, and I'm sure I'm not the only one that thought this, but the word behave, I felt like that was like when you're little and you're told behave, you know, be a good girl, behave. It's like be half of what you are. Just be the good half. Don't ever show me those other sides. And when you start to do any self-reflective process, writing or art or anything, music, you get to look at those other parts and you get to see that, oh, I have that in me.
Uh-huh.
You know, I
uh-huh.
thought she was a real, you know, bitchy person, but I've got that bitchy person in me. And you start, you know, you expand your sense of who you are, and that allows you to be more compassionate to other people because it isn't extracted out there. It isn't projected out there.
And allows you to change yourself.
Exactly.
When you just acknowledge that.
I don't like
that. Put it on the table.
Yeah.
You know? Okay. So now we're getting, so I have another question for you, which is I have that I have kids. Do you think, I feel like the education, this is a total one question. I just want to kind of talk about it, but for me and Lisa, my wife, it's of utmost importance with our kids at the age that they are, that they are creatively supported.
Mm-hmm.
Way more than the fact that they learn science and math. Like, honestly, like, I feel like if I could instill them, like, when I play music with them and we have art supplies everywhere, I think there's a movement in education to make it more about, you know, I want to say like robotic, but that's totally pejorative. But it's sort of like this. We got to teach them math. We got to train them. We got to have workers. We got to make sure.
Because of all the testing.
Right. And I feel like that direction. So I don't know, because you say, I know that you've worked in schools and everything else. Do you feel like that's a direction? I'm feeling like I don't need my daughter Luna to be on a computer right now. I need her to learn how to think.
Yeah.
I didn't grow up with computers and I'm competent on computers. Lisa's brilliant on computers. She didn't grow up with computers. But there's if you can teach somebody how to think, then they can learn the trade. You know, they could very soon, she's going to be in high school or junior high on computers. But right now, if you, what is your feeling on like education and an age appropriate kind of like, this should be more about creativity right now and less about the hard learning?
That's a hard one. I don't know. I know when my kids were going through, they went through, they were very lucky because the Mendocino schools at that point were very much into creative problem solving. And so they had a lot of that developing critical thinking skills, right, as well as whatever else they were learning. I don't know how I feel about that. I definitely think young children really should be given a broad range of exposure to all sorts of things. And if they have a particular affinity for math or something like that,
then foster that.
Yeah, foster that. But don't, if some kid's really struggling, I don't know. I don't know. I worry because of all this testing stuff.
Because it stresses the kids out.
Homework, apparently.
Yeah, they have a lot of homework, but this test come up and they're stressed about it. And I'm just like, you know what? She just wrote two songs, melody and words. And I'm like, that's more important to me than the fact that you can divide. She's 9 years old. She can still divide. And, you know, she's learning math and it's great.
And do they even need that anymore?
I don't know.
You know, that's the other thing. And you know, my kids, Kate, the second one, in kindergarten, I think they started having computers and typing. But it wasn't a huge part of their school thing. Not till high school, I think. And I don't even remember. High school, they were doing a lot of stuff on computers. So that's a whole different thing that I worry about, too, is what is that doing to our sensing ability?
Yes.
If we're always on devices, I mean, definitely our fingers are getting more agile. Yeah. But I'm wondering if our sense of social cues is changing because we're not interacting in the same. I don't know. I can't answer your question.
But I think
would foster, support them, whatever they need to negotiate getting through those tests. But it's hard.
I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I still think you would advocate for parents to foster creativity.
Definitely.
Right. But let's just say schools maybe are moving away. So it becomes utmost important that the family, that there's at least a creative outlet for kids and that parents are creating an informal art therapy session where they're creating a safe place where kids aren't judged in their artwork.
Yeah.
And that translates into the way that the child develops and their own confidence and self-confidence and, right? I mean, all those things.
Yes, totally. Right? I agree.
So now we're getting into the nitty-gritty because a lot of what you talk about is, you know, you do creative play shops and you're an art therapist and you have people who, you know, sign up and do these things. But for people who don't have access to an art therapist, who are, you know, supremely busy raising kids, and what are the things that you would recommend to try? The premise being, the assumption being that people are super busy.
Right.
You know where I'm going with this because I'm the small step advocate. Like, I'm just all about, like, so what would you recommend? What can you advise somebody just in the
I love this question because I think it's so important because we so often set ourselves up for failure by wanting to do something super dramatic and get all these art supplies in and we're going to take courses. I mean, we get so excited about something and then 2 months later they're sitting there unopened and then it's almost like, oh, we better not do that again. That was a big mistake. So in terms of how you can get started, if you're interested, it's really stop, look, and listen. It's the old thing from preschool, but maybe not anymore, but the idea of taking that pause somehow in your busy, busy day, if you can just find a few moments to take a pause. And I came to it with writing and art. You might come to it through something else, like just playing a few notes on a flute or something if you have a recorder at home. I don't know what people have in their homes. Maybe doing something on the computer even with brushes, and there's these different applications now.
Right.
But do one little thing maybe in a day or a week, if you can't manage it a day, whatever my thing is like yours, do something that works for you. But set the intention that you want to reflect more creatively on your life, moment to moment on your life. Okay. So it's like there was a magnet in a friend's house that I loved, and it was something like, what inspired me today? What surprised me today? What challenged me today or what moved me today, something like that. And it's sort of like that's a good frame to start with. Or if you notice things, like in my book I use the example of if you see an elderly couple that are kind of bent over but they're holding hands, that always just makes my heart just expand. It just makes me feel so soft and sweet to see that. If something affects you that way, just jot it down, make a note of it, and then keep a little file maybe of images, or if you have a phone and you're taking pictures and something really catches your eye, snap a photo of it. Just do something simple, and then when you have a little more time, let that talk to you, whatever you did. If you snapped a picture, let that picture go further into you with a little more information. Or if you're just tearing things out of a magazine, like for collaging at some point, if you see a face and it just grabs you, tear it out, put it somewhere. It's kind of like having an idea file or something. A lot of people do vision boards if you have enough time to do something like that. And there's so many books out there. There are so many books on, you know, creative journaling, creative, you know, collaging, different, there's lots of resources if you want to have a practice with it. But to me, it's just kind of having that intention and then giving yourself permission to play, to explore what's going on and then express it somehow.
Like I talk about in my book, like, you know, it can be creating art, but it can also be looking at the art you already have. I mean, I find like in my house, I'll go like, oh yeah, I love that painting, but I haven't looked at it in 5 months and it's on my wall. You know what I mean? Like just taking a moment to look at art.
And you might want to do some music around it. Like, because you're a musician, you might look at that picture and let that stimulate something else. To me, it's about listening to the inside, which is what we don't do. We, you know, we're so bombarded by external stimuli. Thing. And then when we don't have those external stimuli, we have all those internal chatterboxes inside
judgments
us.
And you're
judgments
bad
and, you're and, you know, oh, you well, if you have time, why aren't you doing this project over here that you've put off? Yeah. Instead of like when the impulse... I mean, to me, it's all about an intuitive, instinctual process that just, you know, it's going on. I mean, we have these things that happen to us all day, but they just, and maybe they come out in dreams at night. But if you start to just be a little more aware and then somehow express that awareness so that it's, that you've got a little starting point. I remember in writing my thesis, one of the techniques they gave us was when you're really stuck in writing, just stop in the middle of a sentence because you'll always know how to start the next day because it's already there.
Just get you going.
Yeah, it gets you going. And it's sort of like once you start the process, it really will. If it's something that's meaningful to you, so there has to be the intention, and then I think it leads you onward.
But do you think it? So I'm begging the question here. But do you think it's? I advocate like if somebody wants to. I think journaling is great, like I said before. And I say, if you don't have time to sit down for even 5 minutes, just putting a piece of paper in your pocket with a pencil and writing a single word,
exactly,
that begins the process. But that too could be for art. You could put a piece of paper and a pencil in your pocket and draw a doodle with, with intention. And that's art.
Or without. But the intention is that I'm going to do something.
That's what I mean. It's not like you're on the phone and you happen to doodle. It's like you have this thing and I'm going to start bringing this into my life. Just like I'm bringing a little bit more healthy food and a little bit more movement step by step.
Right.
Creativity fits in that puzzle the exact same way.
Exactly. And scribbles, by the way, I didn't talk about this, but that's one of the real big techniques is to have people do scribbling and often with their non-dominant hand and then look for things in the scribble that kind of pop out, you know, or make things out of that scribble. That's another way if someone has absolutely no idea what they're going to do and they're fearful. It's just a very good way to start. And so that's a very small step to just do a little scribble, maybe every day, or maybe you won't do it every day.
Which takes literally 5 seconds.
Exactly.
Right. And that's and small, but you believe, you can be honest, but you know, you believe that that is act. I mean, that's an act. That begins the process.
Yes, it's like tipping your toe into the stream, you're just tipping it in. But it probably means that if you're testing the waters, you already have a curiosity about what is it like to be in that river, you know. And once you, I don't know, maybe it's just me, but I the people that come to my play shops a lot of times, they'll let me know that it was like it was really fun. They hadn't done that, and often the time they'll want to go a lot longer than the time we plan on.
But we awaken something.
Yes, and they'll take materials back to their room. Yes, yes. They'll do more on their vacation here.
Yeah.
So it's funny how quickly it can come alive again.
Because it's there. Because right
it's there.
The surface. It's right
there.
Under the surface. Yeah. And then even if you do the little, it just translates into all the other parts of your life.
Yeah.
You know, and it is. I'm so glad you mentioned like I think because it's so. It's funny, just like I see these things as all the same kinds of things with, you know, with food. Somebody decides they want to eat better, so then they get the diet book and they get the, you know, the shopping list and everything, and they spend a fortune on all this stuff.
The Vitamix.
the vitamins and all the supplements. And then they for movement, they got to get the gym membership and the right clothing and then with creative things too, they get all the art supplies and all the thing. They spend a fortune on this stuff. That's why people have that perception of like, well, to do that, you have to have a lot of money. No, you don't. A pencil and a piece of paper.
Absolutely.
That begins that process.
Exactly.
Drumming on a desk can begin that process.
Absolutely.
You know? And so it's literally just, it's that when you break it down into something small, then it's become something that you don't go, I'd like to do that, but oh my God, what an undertaking. It's not an undertaking. And even the littlest bit helps.
And what happened to me was, you know, I just did little things. I mean, as I say, I rode in the car. I'd be picking my kids up from school, maybe have 5 minutes or a minute even, and just write something down. There wasn't any like practice per se, but that somehow it was enough that it sort of snowballed. Like I wanted more. I wanted more. I always felt like I was being interrupted in listening to myself. And there was a conversation there that I hadn't really finished. And so it was like, it was a nagging, which happens, I think, when you get somebody on the path to eating better, even if they're not eating better, it's kind of nagging at them.
Yeah,
the awareness has been planted.
Yes, that's all I need.
Yep. And that's what's critical.
Yeah.
I think.
Okay. Well, awesome. Tell me about your, tell me about the book. Where are you at in it, and what's the name of the book?
The name of the book.
You don't have a title? No, I'm joking.
Well, I had so many titles that I don't know really. It's still a little bit up in the air what the title is. But I've been working with an editor. It's pretty much finished in that sense. I mean, there's a few things we're still doing. One of the issues or hurdles has been because I do collaging, it's really important to get permission from the images. And so we're in the process of doing that right now. But I'm really excited about it because, again, it's sort of like preaching to other people and then realizing I want them to honor their process. And this was like a lot of people had said to me, you know, why don't you honor some of the stuff you've done? And so then that became the impetus to actually create a book. And then it became more about, well, what was your story? How did you get to changing from, but I'm not creative, to actually loving to do this and wanting to offer it to other people?
And the book.
Like believing in it as a resource for other people.
And not as a professional artist.
No, not as
which
a professional.
I love, which
yeah,
I
not
love.
As a professional, so artist. And not to have them worry about it leading anywhere
as an end product, but just
to get into the idea that this could be fun. So anyway, we'll see. I'll keep you abreast.
Yeah, you will, I'll keep people, the listeners, posted.
Yes.
on that. So
thank
anyway.
You.
Well, thank you so much for your time, Joan.
You're welcome.
It was lovely
Sid,
to hang out with you.
One philosopher to another.
I know. well, you're only a minor. No, I'm joking.
I know. I'm a minor one. Yep. Okay. Thanks, Sid.
You're welcome. Thanks a lot.
Bye.
All right. Well, that was my conversation with Joan Stanford. I hope you enjoyed that. I certainly did. It was totally fascinating to me. And again, I want to drive the point home that, you know, some of us live in places where we can take these kinds of things on. Some of us don't. Some of us have lifestyles that we can take these things on, and some of us don't. But the fact of the matter is, all of us can do something creative on some level. All of us. I don't care how busy you are. I don't care what your lifestyle is. Just like people have, everybody has time to get up off a chair and walk across the room and get back on the chair. If that's all you can do, that is action. And likewise with creativity, that's why she and I talked about, you know, the piece of paper and a pencil. I can't stress enough, and I'm going to do this until you guys just get so sick of me saying this, that you actually, you know, that you take this stuff on. I can't stress to you enough the power of action. Of just acting. It gets the ball rolling in a real way. And there is an incredible amount of momentum created by just beginning the process. So I'm going to drive that home every week. It's what I'm here for. That's what's what I developed this podcast for. It's why I wrote the book. It's why I have a practice, because I want to break everybody of this. Well, I don't do anything because the idea of doing something is too gargantuan. It's not. I mean, it doesn't have to be. It doesn't have to be. You can start however small will get you going, and you will see what happens when you do. So until next week, please have a good week. Test out the idea of small steps. See what you think. I could be wrong, but I'm not. Anyway, enjoy, and until I come back next week, be well.
Have you found a way to breathe amidst the smoke and choking wind against the ceaseless display, unwavering? I'm still curious, not free.